First rapporteur, then, is Elizabeth, or Lizzie Tyrone, of the surveillance epidemiologist with the surveillance branch at the Division of STD Prevention at CDC. Her topic is the assessment track. Oh, I'm sorry, I'll say this at the front, I'll say it at the end when the room is fuller as well. Field staff, sometime before the end of the meeting, go to the Willow Room and pick up an additional tax-exempt form. And those of you involved in the APPS grantee meeting, the meeting, that meeting site has been changed to the International Ballroom. I'll say those again at the end of the session. Dr. Tron.
Good morning. I'm Lizzie Tironi. Let's see if I can work this. All right, so one of the ways to get more STD prevention for the money is to understand the scope of the problem. So a good assessment of the who, the what, the when, and the where. So I'm going to highlight some of the themes we heard this week around assessment. But as you heard, the first night, there were 182 talks this week and over 400 posters. So this is in no means a comprehensive review. I'm just going to try to highlight some of the interesting things we heard this week. So I think the first theme we can take from the conference regarding assessment is that conducting assessment is common. Almost half of the abstracts submitted to this conference were on assessment, and I would guess that many of the abstracts submitted under the other tracks had some assessment data in them. And I don't think this is surprising. So not only is assessment a core public health function, but we have a lot to assess. So as King Holmes showed during his opening plenary, we have 35 known sexually transmitted infections and over 35 syndromes, and we can measure and assess the biology, the epidemiology, the pathology, and our efforts to prevent and control them. So starting with some infection data we saw this week. We saw the first population-based prevalence estimates for Mycoplasma genitalium in Britain. Sonnenberg and colleagues presented this morning on findings from the National Survey of Sexual Attitudes and Lifestyles. Among females, they found an overall prevalence of 1.2%, and among males, a prevalence of 1.3%. And as shown on the slide, they found differences in both age and gender. And among young adults, prevalence was higher among young females than males. And I think this is a really good example of strong work on assessment of infections at the population level. Sue Blank and colleagues presented data on HIV in New York City. They found that during 2010 to 12, over 10,000 HIV infections were diagnosed and reported, and 11% of them were diagnosed in STD clinics. They had 643 cases of acute HIV infection, and one-fifth of those were diagnosed in STD clinics. And this type of assessment data not only measures the what, but the where, and really highlights how STD clinics contribute to finding acute HIV infection in New York City. We also heard talks about the assessment of health services. This is also from New York City. Pathella and colleagues presented on an assessment of HPV vaccine coverage. They conducted a registry match between medical records and city STD clinics and citywide immunization records. And I think it's worth saying that registry matches like this sound easy, like, oh, we matched 13,000 patient records. But it isn't always an easy step. And I think we're seeing more of this type of assessment. And really understanding the methods to conduct valid registry matches is important. But what they found when they did their match is that among females who started the three-dose vaccine series, their completion rates increased over time. That's the dotted red line on the slide. But in 2013, the completion rate was still less than 70% among females. And the data aren't shown on this slide, but it was less than 35% among boys. So really suboptimal vaccine coverage. And the authors conclude that STD clinics may be a venue for opportunistic HPV vaccination. And I think this is an example of really looking at existing data to find opportunities to improve prevention services. But it's not just about the what and the where. The who also matters. So what populations did we hear about this week? So I looked across the abstracts and identified the primary population of each study, and then I used that list of populations to make a word cloud. So here, the size of the word corresponds to the number of abstracts presenting data on that population. So some caveats, so these are not mutually exclusive groups, so some studies focused on adolescent African-American MSM, and since this coding was done very quickly in the last few days, think of this as an exploratory data analysis. But I think we can see some themes. So first, the populations covered this week correlate well with our priority populations in STD prevention. So we heard a lot of talks on MSM, women, and adolescents and young adults. Second, there are some other key populations that received attention this week, including pregnant women, healthcare providers, and the military. For me, there was a surprising number of talks this week about STDs among the U.S. Armed Forces. And then finally, there were some populations that were not well represented, so you may be squinting to try to read that small font. So at this conference, we didn't hear much about populations like women who have sex with women, older adults, Native Americans, and injection drug users. And it may be that these populations are underrepresented because they're low-risk populations, but it could also be that these are populations that are hidden or harder to reach, representing really areas of needed research. So I think it was clear this week that conducting assessment is common. We assessed a lot of things among a lot of populations. But what also became clear throughout the week, at least for me, is that conducting valid assessment is hard. So many talks this week focused on the ways people evaluate the validity of their assessment measures, as well as to develop strategies to improve validity. So let's start by talking about sex, or at least the way we get others to talk about sex. And here's an example of how valid or invalid measures of sexual behavior can be. So Chow and colleagues in California looked at adolescents' self-reported sexual behaviors during a health interview survey. They used data from a random digit telephone survey of about 3,300 adolescents, and they estimated the proportion of adolescents who reported ever having sex. You can see about 15% of young boys and 11% of girls reported that they had ever had sex. But then they took something into account, whether the adolescent thought their parents were listening during the telephone survey. And what they found, not surprisingly, is that adolescents who thought their parents were listening were much less likely to admit to being sexually active. And this is particularly noticeable for young girls. You can see girls who thought their parents were listening were 3 times less likely to report having had sex. Now, the overall number is small here, so the effect on the aggregate estimate isn't that great, but I think this is a really good example of researchers thinking about and looking at possible threats to validity in their estimates. There were also talks this week about reported condom use, which is also subject to social desirability bias. So Collins and colleagues presented some very early studies on a possible objective marker of condom use, and that's natural rubber latex proteins. So in laboratory studies, they investigated if a rubber latex protein assay could distinguish latex condoms from non-latex condoms and other vaginal products like lubricant. And they found that it could. In fact, their tests could identify latex products with a sensitivity of 95% and a specificity of 98%. So this is really early work. It's really kind of a proof of concept, and their next steps are human studies. But I think this is a good example of work being presented this week on developing methods to increase valid assessment. So it wouldn't be an STD conference if we didn't talk about the scary resistant gonorrhea, and we talked about it a lot. There were 2 symposiums, a plenary, a mini plenary, and 2 oral sessions, all covering AMRGC. We saw data on the susceptibility of Neisseria gonorrhea to the cephalosporins. Bob Kirkcaldy presented the U.S. data on the left, which showed in the last 2 years a reversal in trends of decreased susceptibility, which suggests we might be seeing fewer isolates with resistance. And similar trends were observed in England and Wales. That's the data on the right. Now, these trends correlate with changes in gonorrhea treatment guidelines, but we need additional studies to understand really what's driving these trends. And while they're encouraging, continued surveillance and the search for new drug continue to be needed. We also heard talks this week about genome sequencing of Neisseria gonorrhea, which can help us learn more about the mutations causing resistance. Pictured here is work presented from folks at Harvard and at the Public Health Agency of Canada. We also heard some promising data about a point-of-care test for gonorrhea. So researchers from Baltimore presented on a microwave-accelerated metal-enhanced fluorescent test, and the test can detect gonorrhea DNA in less than 10 minutes and can tell if the strain is missing the mutations associated with resistance. And I think it's really studies like this that are bringing us closer to a point-of-care test that could allow us to individualize treatment to really maximize the use of existing drugs that we have. But it wasn't just all about AMRGC. We also heard about other novel diagnostics to improve assessment. Darville and colleagues investigated if we could identify asymptomatic women at risk for PID with a minimally invasive test. So can we identify just those couple of women in a large pool of women? And the answer seems to be maybe. So they reported that a microarray analysis of whole blood can identify women with infection-induced PID and pathogen-specific transcriptional networks. And these networks could be used to identify genes important in determining risk for disease. And diagnostic tests like this can help improve assessment of individuals at risk and can provide surrogate endpoint markers to evaluate novel therapies and vaccine candidates. So we also heard a lot about big data this week and found that bigger isn't always better, but sometimes it is. So Flagg and colleagues looked at using administrative data for STD surveillance, and in a really comprehensive poster, they looked at multiple types of administrative data, and they provided a nice summary of the pros and cons. So some of what they found is that administrative is really a good venue for monitoring trends in non-reportable conditions, and it can be low cost since the data are already collected. But there are some cons. Often administrative data doesn't contain laboratory results, so it can be difficult to monitor trends in infection. And of course, one of the biggest limitations is that administrative data isn't always timely, so there's often a lag. Still, using big data, like administrative data, can be an important complement to our other assessment data. We also heard talks this week about using another type of data, and that's using data from sites like Facebook, Google Earth, Twitter, to assess behaviors to help inform surveillance. And during a plenary talk from a speaker at Google, we heard that we might be able to learn about hidden behaviors of men, particularly men in conservative states, if we look at the things their wife Googles. So I think it really became clear during the Q&A sessions in these big data talks that there are a lot of unanswered questions about how we're going to use these data sources. But there also was a lot of brainstorming during the Q&A sessions, and I really have a feeling that we're going to hear a lot more about these type of data at our next meeting. So another theme we saw this week is innovative methods to conduct better assessments. So there are people who not only had that innovative idea, but they also had the energy and the motivation to implement it. So one example is Koning colleagues, who looked at their 2013 syphilis and HIV partner services data in San Francisco, and they identified networks of named partners. So not surprisingly, they found a lot of dyads, like the one pictured here. Some of the networks were larger, but they also found what they called the mega network. So this is a network of 435 partners that were identified through partner services in 1 year. So here it's shown by gender. Only two of the individuals were women. That's the red dots at the bottom, and one was a transgendered female, the orange square. This version shows the HIV status of HIV of each person in the network. The red boxes were HIV positive at the beginning of 2013. The blue were HIV negative, and the grays were unknown. Now, for me, I'm a data person, so the coolest thing about this for me is just that they did it, right? And they did it using their routine partner data. And from what we were told this morning, they did it in a relatively easy way if you have Bob Cohn working with you. So I think that being more than just cool to look at, there really are some interesting stuff here that can inform prevention, like identifying mixing patterns. And these type of assessment data can provide useful information to simulation models as well. Okay, so my final example of innovative methods comes from researchers who asked, what is the coverage of chlamydia testing among young women in the U.S.? And they asked this because published testing coverage varies widely, from 21% to almost 70%. So to try to make sense of these conflicting data points, the authors use a multi-parameter evidence synthesis where they use multiple data sources and model their relationships using a Bayesian statistical framework. And by looking across data sources, they estimated screening coverage in the U.S. to be about 30%, but acknowledged that further work is needed and to incorporate other factors. But I think this is a really great example of the direction we're moving in assessment, and that's pulling together multiple data sources to answer our tough questions. So in summary, I think it's clear we're fulfilling the core public health function of assessment, and as highlighted, conducting valid assessment is hard, but there are innovative tools and strategies being developed and used to increase validity to make sure we are getting the most prevention for our money. And with that, I just want to acknowledge the folks listed here who helped with this review. Thank you.